Our doctor is in, and so are the doctors of Capital Health. Welcome to the all-new Health 411. Every Sunday morning at 10, Dr. Jonathan Karp, along with our respected panel of guests from Capital Health, take you on an important medical journey to help you navigate your health and the healthcare system to reach your destination, good health. Health 411 is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.
107.7 The Bronx, 107.7TheBronx.com. We're proudly nominated for a National Associate of Broadcasters 2019, 2021, and 2022 Marconi Award for Best College Radio Station. And we won a 2023 IBS College Media Award for universities under 10,000 students. We are broadcasting from the Bronx All Digital Studios on the campus of Rider University in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Welcome to Health 411. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp, and I'm here with Dan Geller, our student producer. This Health 411 program is presented by Capital Health. In Health 411, we discuss a variety of issues affecting health and wellness, public health, healthcare policy, and the science of health and healthcare. Our goal is to expand your knowledge and perspective. That introduction make it sound like because all we do is like serious, heavy-handed, like nerdy, sciencey stuff.
Yeah,
does it sound like that? But you picked a topic for today, Dan, that's a little different than the kinds of things we usually do. What did you want to talk about today?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about head transplants.
Head transplants. And well, we don't mean deporting like drug users from one state or out of the country or something.
Head
like that.
Transplant, okay.
Yeah.
Not that kind of head transplant.
I'm making fun. But what we're talking about here is the possibility that one may be able to take the head from one animal, including a person, and transplant it onto another body.
Yeah, like in the same way you transplant a kidney or a heart.
Correct. And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's sort of an interesting topic. It's not the kind of thing that I spend a lot of time talking about it. But what stimulated you to think about this, Em?
Literally nothing. I was thinking, well,
there had to be something.
Well, there had to be something, right? So I was thinking, we don't have a guest for this week, but there is some.
That's not a reason. There has to be something else. That's not a good reason.
I thought it was cool. I thought, I've read about it previously.
There you go. Did you read what I'm trying to get at is, did you read something in something that could be considered a peer-reviewed journal, or were you watching like a cartoon?
It just spurred me in the moment. I just thought, I want to talk about head transplants. I'm going to look up a paper on it. And that's when I sent it to you.
Okay. So what Dan going was a paper that came out in a journal called the Journal of Clinical Medicine in 2019. Called First Human Head Transplantation, Surgically Challenging, Ethically Controversial, and Historically Tempting, an Experimental Endeavor or a Scientific Landmark. And this is a relatively short article written by two people from a university in Greece. And they sort of put some things out there, but they're not the only people who have talked about this recently, are they?
Recently, no. There's been plenty of people. So the guy who's actually trying to do the procedure has written a good body of work on it. His name is Canavero, an Italian surgeon.
Right. And this guy, Canavero, his name comes up a lot.
Yeah.
In the little bit of time that I had to look at this, I found his name out there. And it sounds like he is a surgeon who has published himself as well. In fact, he has a fairly recent editorial that came out in December 2022. In an open access journal called Surgical Neurology International, and the title of his editorial is Whole Brain Transportation in Man Technically Feasible. I don't know if you saw that.
I hadn't seen that one.
But this guy Sergio Canavero is sort of putting out sort of the idea that, you know, whole brain, or what you call head transplantation, is technically feasible.
Yeah.
In our discussion, one of the things that I think we need to do is separate the idea of a head transplant from a brain transplant, right? One of those things that is a little bit different.
Yeah.
But it's the idea that, you know, you basically want to transplant the brain and everything around the brain from one head to like a donor body, take off the head.
That's the brain transplant. It's just the brain.
Right, just the brain. Well, that's not how it started out, because there's a, in the hall coming in the area, you said there's a little bit of a history of people who have actually tried this, not in...
Not in people. Yeah, so the first thing that I could find, the earliest record of a head transplant was a guy named Charles Guthrie tried to transplant the head of a donor dog onto the neck of a recipient dog, but it wasn't successful.
Well, when did this happen?
1908.
So this is like over 100
years
ago. Yeah,
this is a long time ago.
Right, and this is like around the time that like Pavlov was doing his stuff with his dogs too, and like the rules were a little bit different.
Yeah, with ethics and stuff.
Right, the ethics and the animal welfare regulations were completely different. 100 years ago, especially, I think this probably happened in Russia. I'm not sure.
Charles Guthrie.
That might be United States.
Yeah, that might be.
I know there were some people in the mid part of last century who were doing it who sounded pretty Russian as well. Mm-hmm. But these are some of the things. The idea for doing this, I'm going to test your ability to be part of a liberal arts environment. The idea that you could separate like one's brain or head from one's body, is that something that is, you know, in the past 100 years or so kind of thing that people are doing, or does it have a genesis in the roots of sort of natural philosophy?
I think it has real genesis in science fiction. I think that's where people first thought of a head transplant.
No, I'm going to say it goes back farther than that. And I'm not saying Descartes. You ever heard of this guy, René Descartes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he lived like in the mid 1600s-ish kind of thing. He came up with this idea of the brain in a bottle, or the brain in a vat, I think he called it.
Okay.
And it's sort of like trying to understand thought and awareness and reality. And the idea was, if you could separate one's brain from your body and sort of put it in a vat or put it in a bottle, what would you
perceive?
Mm-hmm. Like, what would your reality be?
I think I've asked you that question before.
Well, you might. Well, it's not a new question.
Certainly not.
It goes back many, many hundred years. There was a twist on that he took it, sort of the idea that there was he was talking about it in the concept of God, you know, but what if it wasn't a benevolent God? What if it was a bad God, a maleficent God? Mm-hmm. And now your brain is in the bottle, and you have like an evil God controlling your thoughts and perceptions and your reality, kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of thing. But the idea that your brain could be in a vat goes back, hundreds of years. So when you see like science fiction movies,
so I guess they really got their ideas from Descartes.
well, in a sense, yeah. When you go back to something like The Matrix, where they've got not taking the heads off critters, but they're taking whole bodies, sort of putting them in a vat, keeping it alive, and a computer or an outside entity is sort of controlling reality, mm-hmm. right? That we have the technology to sort of make that happen, like in a computer simulated a CGI world of the mm-hmm. movies. But even without all that technology, it's the kind of thought experiment some famous philosophers had going back hundreds of years, including Descartes.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of an aside, but even nowadays you have people, there's plenty of corporations, I don't want to know corporations, but companies that will let you freeze either your whole body or just your head in hopes that one day
we're aware of that. And that was, I don't know how popular it is now, but when they started doing that, it was probably like in the 1980s or something like that.
Yeah.
And they were dropping these heads into liquid nitrogen with the hope that someday they could be connected. But that's what we want to talk about. We want mm-hmm. to talk about, so have some fun with that to see if it's, can we figure out if it's even viable. Is it a way to separate people from their money? Or something else.
Yeah. The third option.
Well, there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
You know? There are no, in a sense, there are no atheists in the trenches. There's mm-hmm. there's an expression that says that.
No atheists in the trenches.
Yeah. You ever hear that?
I haven't heard that one.
That's sort of the idea that if you find people who are desperate, who are scared, all of a sudden they find God. Mm-hmm. Even though they didn't believe in God
before,
when everything was healthy and very, very good, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean there is or isn't a God. It just means that people sometimes who didn't believe, like, want to find something when they encounter something sort of bad. Now, the interesting thing about the little bit of literature that it sounds like we were both able to find is a lot of the literature sort of based on the technical feasibility. Now, we can talk about some of the philosophy, and I hope we do that in subsequent segments. We can talk about the philosophy, like I said. We can talk about the mechanics, about this surgical procedure.
Which is interesting, too. They use, right, like, microscopic needles and stuff to get this done.
Well, you're saying it like it's actually going on. But the Caravero, Dr. Caravero, when he writes, is talking about some modern technological advances in terms of the knives, mm-hmm, and the ability to connect vessels and things like that, that, you know, he's saying it's sort of possible. The history, some of the reasons, some of the historical attempts to do that you briefly brought up with dogs and monkeys and even mice have to do with keeping tissues alive. So a lot of that's the technical part. I also want to get into the anatomical part, the neuroanatomical component of it, which the articles that I was able to find don't so much address, but coming from a background in neuroscience, we could talk about what that even is. And we will start the next segment talking about so one thing I talk about in my brain and behavior class, introduction to brain and behavior, is the brain in the bottle idea, to address some of those science fiction things that are out there. And we'll come right back and we'll do that on Health 411 after some brief underwriting announcements. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronc and 107.7 The Bronc Doc.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronc, 107.7TheBronc.com. We're recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronc Studios. Oh, welcome back. Dan and I are having a conversation today about the possibility of head transplants or brain transplants. They're a little bit different, but they're somewhat related. And there have been historically people have tried this. I mean, as thought experiments, and we mentioned Descartes and other philosophers who are sort of looking at, conceptions of reality, the mind, truth, whatever you want to call it, consciousness, and they came up with the idea that, you could separate one's head. People have actually tried this. You mentioned some dog experiments that were done over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons why that even if you do these things, they fail, right? And I came up with a list of some of the reasons why these transplants historically has failed. One of them is the easiest one to talk about, or in my mind, is tissue transplantation, right?
I mean,
in general, you just can't take an organ from one person or one animal and transplant it to another. Why?
Because of the antibodies that will attack the new tissue.
Tissue rejection.
Like, yeah.
It's not always antibodies.
I gotcha.
But do you have immune response? Right. And there's different kinds of immune responses. You can have, the host body rejecting a graft. You can also have a graft versus host disease. And the immunology is a little bit different. But when people first started actually doing this, 100, 150 years ago, they didn't know about, MHC compatibility in humans and things like that. They didn't even know about, blood typing. Mm-hmm. You can't just take any other critter's blood, right? There's all this tissue, blood typing kind of thing that goes on. And so that sort of technology, that sort of science didn't exist. So that's one reason why historically these things have failed. There's other things having to do with being able to connect the vasculature, right? Like some things like some of the bigger vessels are like, the internal carotid arteries that go up the neck, mm-hmm, and feed the head.
The jugulars.
Well, that's a vein.
Yeah.
That's one of the major vessels that's going to take blood away, mm-hmm, that goes down the neck. And so being able to stitch or sew or reconnect vessels has been a major problem, mm-hmm, being able to do that. And those are some of the major vessels. You also have to have the technology to be able to reconnect some of the major nerves, like being some of the cranial nerves that come out of the sort of the midbrain, pons, and medulla, the brain stem, mm-hmm, kinds of stuff, and the 12 cranial nerves, they have to be connected. There has to be a reconnection of the spinal cord, those kind of severing kinds of those nerve connections don't necessarily work. There has to be a way to keep the tissues alive between when they are severed from one critter and added to another. And that's the kind of thing that even if you practice on a cadaver, which some people have done to try to get all this stuff right, the cadavers, you don't have to worry about keeping the cadaver body alive.
Yeah, you don't need to worry about life.
You don't have to worry about keeping the cadaver's head alive. And there's also ways to, you have to figure out ways to, the brain is not a solid organ. It's full of cerebral spinal fluid and ventricles that is constantly circulating it all the time. So there has to be some sort of perfusion.
So it's not as easy as just connecting some fake blood vessels.
No, it's not like it is in the movies where that you can just cut something off and plop it on.
Plop it on.
And you see that sometimes in the movies, you know, heads get tried on different bodies. And
I have seen that, yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, it'd be a great way if somebody wanted, you know, if people would, you know, gender dimorphia disorder, it feels like, oh, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. Wouldn't that be great if you could just transplant the body and have that happen? But it doesn't work.
So it sounds like the only issue with this procedure or a theoretical... Like,
the only issue?
Is not just how to do the surgery. You need to worry about a lot of things before and a lot of things after.
That's a big part of what I want to talk about with you, because the articles that are out there, like this physician from Italy you mentioned... he was written extensive articles on this over the past 10 years or so. Most of his articles are about the technical achievements in finding, you know, knives that are more and more narrow to get like a thinner slice through the spinal cord. About how advances in suturing technology for the vessels. He's also written about advances when these first transplants were done 100, 150 years ago, and who knows what was going on before all this was recorded or people tried to publish it. You know, advances in immunosuppressive drugs and immunosuppressive therapies. None of this existed.
Never, not even like as a thought. I mean, when this was first being tried, they didn't really understand germs, let alone blood types.
Microbes. Right, you know, so you absolutely right. So all this sort of stuff is part of the technical stuff that has to be achieved in order to make this feasible. What was sort of interesting in that article that spurred you on, that was written by those two people from Greece, I read it and, you know, and they sort of go through these sort of things, you know, and they're sort of challenged at saying, when the first kidney transplants were done, they were met with a lot of kickback. People said you shouldn't do that. When the first heart transplants were done, blah, 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 blah. You know, and people claimed, oh, you shouldn't intervene. You shouldn't play the hand of God.
Right.
Right. The problem with that is all medicine is intervening in the hand of God. And that was actually, 150 years ago, there were people who said, you know, if somebody... like shoot you with an arrow or shoot you with a bullet because guns were becoming, you know, that you shouldn't try to treat that person. You shouldn't try to save that person because God wanted you to get hit. God wanted you. You didn't die right away because God wanted you to suffer. And so medical interventions, you know, at one point were all, there were people on the other side saying you should never do this. You shouldn't save a mother and a baby if one of them's going to die in childbirth, because obviously if one of them or both of them are going to die, that was what?
That was God.
God was God's will, right? God wanted the mother or child or both to die in childbirth, and it was heresy to try to change that.
What time frame are we talking? Like the
1600s? No, I'm talking about
1800s.
1800s.
1800s,
yes.
Interesting.
Right? And there was a big push, and I know about the U.S. the most, in the mid to late 1800s to turn medicine into a formal profession, a formal practice, and to have medical schools, to have formal training with all this medical science was coming. You remember, you know, bleeding used to be done by barbers. That was the red on the barber pole. You know,
really?
It was because they used to bleed people. And there's a famous picture about the stone, removal of the stone of madness, a barber bleeding somebody. He's got the big funnel on his head. That was to collect all the blood, you know? And so the push to like make medicine a science that was respectable, that was evidence-based, to get away from the idea that you're changing God's will, was as recently as the mid-1800s or so, kinds of stuff. But I come back to the end of this article that was written by these Greek authors that I mentioned in the first segment, and at the end they write, are we ready to accept the advances and make a step forward? Are we ready to handle the incompetence to confront terminal diseases and give a solution?
I think any science needs trepidation like that.
Well, that's true, but that, you know what,
it's a powerful thing to say.
No, I disagree.
You don't think so?
I read that as a playground dare, right? I dare you to do something on the playground. Right? And that's what it sounds like.
I dare you to transplant
right?
ahead.
I took offense to this because it's saying, ethics be damned, the technical things be damned. They're promoting it. They want this to develop. They want this to be a thing, which I think is great. They're saying we shouldn't be afraid, just like people shouldn't be afraid of kidney transplants or other kinds of transplants, or I'm going to add in like face transplants.
I was going to say like face transplants are also a big thing.
I took their challenge at the end of their paper as like a dare, and I'm like, this is like ridiculous. Who do they think's reading this? Mm-hmm. Like on the playground, hey Dan, I dare you to go do this. There are things that have to be considered, like the brain in the vat sort of idea. And one of the things when I'm teaching a introductory brain and behavior course, and you have students who are English majors, history majors, whatever they are, the first day or the first week of class, you're just trying to get them interested in this. Like, why should I care about the brain? Blah, 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 blah. I have one. I don't care how it works. Right. So you have to talk about some of this natural philosophy sort of idea, and you come back to the brain in the bottle sort of ideas. And one of the things that came out of it is there's also there's another famous philosopher, and I'm forgetting who came up with the floating man analogy. Have you heard of that?
I haven't heard of
that. That's not isolating the head, but that's like putting a body into something that is completely devoid of any sensory input. Would you have any awareness? But all this comes back to is, what is your brain doing? Your brain is collecting information from the outside world, combining it with what's happening in your body and creating your reality. So all you're ever going to know about the nervous system is what your brain tells you is real or not real. That's why we can change things, how our nervous system works, and then we can hear and see things. People do this all the time with drugs, right? The issue is if you isolate a brain from the rest of the body, this is an organ that's developed with sensory input coming in from certain organs, certain sizes, certain connections, since it was in utero, when it came out of utero, all this sort of stuff. If you cut that off from what the brain is doing, it's not going to have some sort of internal consciousness that exists in the absence of all this sensory input that's coming in. So the idea is that even if I could transplant a head or a brain to a new body, right? And let's say I could overcome all these technical sort of things, it wouldn't have the same perceptions of itself or the world around it, because the inputs that has been using to create those perceptions for however long it existed before are no longer there. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and we'll follow up that thought after some brief underwriting announcements on Health 411. You are listening to 107.7
There's no appointment needed
Bronx
for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx, 107.7thebronx.com. Welcome back to Health 411. Dan and I are continuing our conversation. What are we talking about today, Dan?
Head transplants,
which are a little bit different than brain transplants, but technically a little bit different perceptionally right now, because if you're doing a whole head transplant, you're going to assume that the ears come with it, the eyes come with it, all these sort of things. And what you're really concerned about is reconnecting the head to the spinal cord, to the vasculature, to all those things that are sort of below the neck. If you're doing a brain transplant, the head is going to stay intact, but what you have to do is reconnect the brain to the vasculature. You have to reconnect the nerves and all that sort of stuff. In the last segment, we talked a little bit about some of the technical issues that are being worked on. I mean, for all transplant, you know, dealing with immunological issues. You mentioned dealing with clean issues that prevent like infection, the idea that microbes exist. You have to do this under sterile conditions. Even though the brain isn't what they call an immune privileged organ, it doesn't mean there are no immune-like activity happening.
I thought that wasn't a thing. I thought the brain was not immunoprivileged.
Well, it's immune privileged, meaning that what's happening in the brain is not a lot. The cells of the immune system do not easily go in and out of the brain like they do other places in the body. There is a thing called a blood-brain barrier that keeps the extracellular fluid of the brain different than the extracellular fluid of the rest of the body. And physiologically, that's really, really important, because if the job of the nervous system is to collect sensory information from the outside world and produce appropriate behavior, you want that behavior to be relatively stable. The way that the cells in the brain work is they're very, very sensitive to what's in the extracellular space. So you can't have that extracellular space changing its composition based on you just ate a meal or you haven't eaten in a long time and blah, 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 blah. All these things that happen, you want the nervous system to be the behavior to be relatively stable in an ever-changing world. So the cells have to be in this basically stable environment kind of thing that goes on. Again, that's one of the things that's going to change if you basically cut off a person or animal's head. You have to maintain that stability. You're an EMT, correct?
I am.
If you come across somebody who has stopped breathing and you're an EMT and you show up, how long do you have to get them breathing again?
3 to 4 minutes.
Okay, a really short amount
of
time.
Really short amount
of
time.
Why?
Because the brain takes up a lot of oxygen very quickly.
What I want to say is you don't care about their lungs. You don't care about their muscles.
We care about the brain.
Right.
Brain death is the main
concern
here.
You don't care about their gonads or their spleen. Mm-hmm. You want to get them breathing again because of the nervous system tissue. Because the nervous system is an oxygen hog, it's an energy hog. Relative to its size, it uses like 20% of the body's oxygen. It's not 20% of the body's size, right? And so it's an energy hog. It's one of the things that's happened in evolution. And what happens is if you cut the brain off from a constant supply of oxygen, what happens?
Death. Cell death. Ischemia.
Ischemia is the word for low brain perfusion of blood. But what happens at the cellular level is apoptotic cell death. That's an active process of active cell death. Now imagine taking the head off or even the brain out. You have to keep that perfusion. You have to keep that oxygenation kind of thing going.
We sort of do that now with heart transplants as well. There's
a heart and lung machine.
A heart and lung machine, exactly.
To keep it going.
But how do you do that with the brain?
The brain is a lot more sensitive. Like I said, you have only minutes before apoptotic cell death. That's why if somebody has not just ischemia, but actually has a stroke, where blood supply is not necessarily reduced, but stopped, the cell death starts in minutes to hours to days, and it accumulates over time. That's why the worst thing you can do to tell a grandma after a stroke is lay down and rest because you've had a stroke. Because that cascade of apoptotic cell death is going to accelerate. Right? So if we're going to talk about transplanting somebody's head and brain, you don't want to, it's the young Frankenstein thing. Go get me a brain. Here's Abby Normal's brain. You know what I mean? You don't want to take a relatively normal brain and have it essentially undergo a stroke and then put into a body.
Counterintuitive.
Well, it's not counterintuitive. It would be a bad thing to sort of have it happen. these are all like the technical ideas. But like I said, people are getting better at it. There was one person in one of these articles at the history who found sort of a solution to that in mouse brain. So instead of taking the whole mouse head off, he only cut like one carotid artery and one jugular, and he kept the mouse's body alive to continue to perfuse the brain. He hooked up the one he cut to like another mouse's head and then cut the other one. People who are thinking about this and doing this are doing, weird ass stuff like that. But when you read the little bit that I read on these articles, they're not bringing up that brain in the vat sort of analogy idea. They're not, because if you do it with these animals, you can't ask a mouse or a rat or a dog what are you thinking? What are you feeling? You could only do it by looking at the animal's behavior. And just because you get like a keeping a head alive, just keeping an organ alive and the skin alive and the eyes alive, well, whatever you want to keep alive, just keeping it alive is not the same thing as transplanting it from one critter to another and having it work like it did in the previous thing. And like I was saying at the end of the previous segment, the thought experiment of putting the brain in the bottle is the idea is that if your reality is created by your brain, and that's what all these philosophers, that's what they're all getting
at. I think therefore I am,
right? And the question is, if you could eliminate all the sensory input, everything else, what would you think? Would you know where you are? Would you know what's happening? And I think the modern view of neuroscience is you wouldn't, because your brain creates that reality. And it creates it based on its experience. And in my case, it's, 50-something years of experience. My brain is used, you've got 20-something years of experience. And if I took your brain out and I put your head on my body, your everything about your, not every, but so many things would be about your reality would be so different. Your size would be different.
Different body.
Yeah, you'd be completely different. And that would change your reality. It's the other argument, we can both look at the wall and see it's cranberry, but do we agree on what cranberry really is?
Or
is that our brain's creation that we both agree that it's cranberry, but is it really the same? Because there's a difference between sensation and perception. All your neurons do is collect stuff and organize it and send it up to your brain, and your brain creates that reality from it. Right. And so we can agree on what something is. But does that mean we agree in the external? It's really the same thing.
Yeah, it's all relative.
We just agreeing on something. So it's sort of metaphoric. Right.
Yep. It's like saying I can't look through your eyes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm a proof to you. I'm a product of a liberal arts environment. Related to these thought experiments you're making me think about. There's one that has the idea. Let's say you had twins. Let's say you had a twin on the Earth and a twin on another planet, right? The twin on the other planet has a different reality. Things are different. And you can, I can look at the classic example. I can look at a cat here on Earth and I can agree that that's a cat. The person on the other planet can have a concept of a cat, but it might be very, very different than the concept of what I look at and my brain creates a reality of a cat. Imagine what that is if you
switched heads of the twins.
If you literally
switched heads of the twins.
And that's sort of what you'd, because in the ideal sense, whose body would you want? You would want the body of a genetically identical person that would reduce the amount of, immunocompromising drugs that you would need, which might be so high it could kill you. You wouldn't want to have to prevent tissue rejection and kill you, damage your kidneys kind of stuff. But that would be the kind of thing. And there's ethics about that. And there's science fiction and books about this too. Rich people are going to be born, or they're going to create a colony of clones
that they harvest
the organs from when
designer
they get older.
Children pick your hair color, pick your height, your weight, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a little different, but it's the same idea. But all this, these science fiction movies and these books, these ideas, the genesis for these things are based in the liberal arts. So if you wanted an argument for why is a liberal arts education good, because part of it is, and kids coming out of high school don't realize this, part of it is good because if you read old stuff, and the critics, old white men from 500 years ago, but sometimes the ideas that they have have survived throughout history, and they're used in unique and novel ways. Whether it's the Matrix or it's the cloning farm books kind of thing, where you're harvesting organs of clones that rich people are islands
the,
about.
It's called The Island. There's a movie called The Island.
Yeah,
which is exactly
it was
that.
A book before it was.
Oh,
a movie.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. But I haven't seen the movie, but I did read the book. But like I said, I know that kind of scientific, science fiction kind of literature is out there, and it has its roots in the liberal arts, which is actually sort of cool. And I'm not an expert in it. I'm just remembering stuff sort of as we're talking, kind of thing, whether that's good or bad. But it relates to this idea of, head transplants or brain transplants. And, there's a whole ethical component that I want to follow up on a little bit. You do that, or are there other things you want to talk about in our last segment?
I want to talk about how they did, how they think they should do the surgery. They laid out some steps of how it should happen.
Well, let's do a little bit of both after we take a break for some underwriting announcements. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx, 107.7thebronx.com. We are recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronx Studios. Welcome back. Dan and I are having a conversation, and this is our last segment today of talking about brain and head transplants. A little bit of the history, a little bit of the ethics, a little bit of the practicality. In the last segment, Dan said he wanted to talk about, you know, conceptually.
How they would do it.
How they would do it, which is sort of jumping on the bandwagon of Dr. Sergio Canavero. Mm-hmm. In Italy, who has written for the past 10 years or so. And like I mentioned earlier, he has an editorial out in the Surgical Neurology International Journal in December 2022 called Whole Brain Transportation in Man, Technically Feasible. So he's not even asking a question. He's saying technically it's feasible. I'm going to say, and we're going to talk about this, Dan, well, I'll let you drive it, that it's even if it is technically feasible, which means you're keeping the tissues alive in terms of transplanting consciousness and awareness and personality and a reality. My background says that might not happen, mm-hmm. but let's talk about what you wanted to talk about, right. About the technical physiology.
The technical way this works, right? So first let's talk about the barriers we had, right? So the barriers to the procedure, like you said earlier, were donor body selection, finding a donor body, the interventions you have to actually do on the head and body, ischemia time, and actually reattaching the nerves and vasculature that was in the head. To sort of do this procedure, they had to have two different teams, and basically the body they used, the recipient body, would have to have some sort of autoimmune disease or disease that would...
I want to be careful. They're not doing this. What they're doing right now is saying, if we're going to do this, hypothetically, what would you want the first attempts at a head transplant to look like, mm-hmm. right? And so what they're getting at is the first attempt, you want somebody who has a brain that's healthy.
Mm-hmm. But a maybe body a that body, might be.
A body that's not, that might not be. And that would be what kind of patient, for example?
I don't know. Let's say stomach cancer.
Yeah,
or maybe metastatic.
Somebody who has maybe some sort of neuromuscular wasting disease.
Okay, yeah,
right. Something like that. Something where their nervous system is intact, not an ALS patient, which isn't like a nervous system patient, but some sort of neuromuscular kind of peripheral disorder, right?
Yeah.
And the idea was their brain is fine, their cognition is fine, everything works, right? And then they find a body.
And then that's
healthy.
That's where, you know, once you get past that, that's when you can start thinking about what nerves do I cut? How do I do this?
Let's come back. Is it just the nerves?
It's everything.
It's not everything. You have to be specific. What do you have to do? Well, on the body, you're going to have to take off the head. Well, there's going to have to be at what vertebrae do you cut?
Which they all list that. I'm not going to go into like the very, very specific details.
And how far down in the brain do you go? Do you leave the midbrain pons and medulla intact and just remove a little higher up? For the midbrain pons and medulla are some of the evolutionarily older parts. That's what you sort of need for breathing, heart rate, and blood pressure. Right?
That's how like the brain stem, right? That's the back of the brain.
Yeah, right. Those collectively things are called the brain stem, right? So you leave them. So maybe you just want to cut just where the skull is and cut it off. So you have to decide where to cut. How much of the nervous system to leave intact? Okay.
Yeah, you have to figure out where to cut. How do you leave the nervous system intact? And what do you do with that head once you've taken it off the body? How do you keep that tissue from just dying?
There has to be some sort of perfusion.
And so what they're doing is they're freezing it to 10 Celsius and running a mixture through it. I think they called it, what was it? It was some sort of solution.
So it's something And this does exist. The military does use it. When I worked as a technician, I actually did this with red blood cells. You can have some sort of artificial blood, right? That's going to provide oxygen, right, to the cells in the brain. So some sort of artificial perfusion media.
Right. And then you need to do that for both the head and for the body. And it's going to be more complicated for the body just because there's more tissue there.
Yeah. And the volume is bigger. And stuff.
And like I think the cutoff time they had of this, you know, no tissue connection is an hour. So they need to reconnect the head and the body within an hour.
And so you're an EMT. When I asked you, how long do you have to get the brain?
2 to 4 minutes, right? Before apoptotic cell death.
Right. And certainly by 8 or 9, it's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad. And they're giving an hour. But I guess that has to do with the fact that they're freezing the head. That sort of slow cell death.
And I want to ask you this, because you brought up in the first segment that there are people, I'm aware of it as recently as the 1980s, who were dying and would have like their head frozen with the idea that sometime in the future my brain can be reconnected. And those heads are not being, for 10 degrees is not freezing.
Well, yeah,
Celsius. We're talking about Celsius here. They're putting basically in liquid nitrogen and they're frozen. But what happens to tissue that you freeze?
You get ice crystals form, and those ice crystals destroy neurons.
Well, they destroy cells.
Yeah.
Because what happens to water when it freezes as opposed to other things?
Expands.
It expands. And if you have water in cells that are expanding and you freeze it,
it's going to die.
The cell membranes rupture. Mm-hmm. And you can see that like even in like meat that you put it in the freezer for too long.
Yeah, you got like freezer burn on your chicken nuggets
that's
or something.
That's part of it because dehydrated cells. Right, all that sort of stuff. So chilling things. So hypothermia is a technique that's used even to infants for surgery and stuff like that. Keeping organs. They put organs on ice when they're transporting for transport and things like that. So that's pretty good. Keep going. What else do they need to do?
They need to reconnect it. And so the main challenge they have with reconnecting the head to the body is the spinal cord. How do you cut open a spinal cord? And that's trauma. That's trauma to the spinal cord if you cut it in half. How do you get it back together? And I think they were using a polyethylene glycol glue that has the ability to reconstitute cell membranes.
Okay, so let's take pause on that. Yes, they did talk about that, something about using polyethylene glycol. There's other
things.
Companies are developing magnetic beads. We see stuff. But think about what the spinal cord is, right? The spinal cord is a conduit. It's a highly organized conduit of information going up and information going down. The information going down there are cells that have their cell bodies, like, you know, higher up in the brain, that are sending axons all the way down, like, you know, in humans, spinal cord could be 3 or 4 feet long. Those cells are going all the way in.
It's one cell top to bottom is what you're saying.
No, but there are cells that project all the way down.
Gotcha.
There are cells that project all the way up. There are inner neurons in the gray areas, but the white areas, the outer part of the spinal cord. If you look at a cross section of the spinal cord, it has a white outer edge and it's sort of a gray area. Those white areas on the outer edges that contain the ascending and descending fibers that all have areas, they all have names. Like the anterior lateral system, the dorsal column, medial meniscal system, blah, 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 blah. They have these, you know, these names in fiber, but all those are axons that are going up and down. When you cut the spinal cord, those axons are going to be cut. The cell bodies that are keeping those tissues alive can be feet away, right? In the gray matter of the spinal cord, there are inner neurons in there. You have the dorsal horn and the ventral horn. The cells that are in the information that's coming into the dorsal horn, the cell bodies are outside the nervous system. They're in the dorsal root ganglia. They project into the dorsal horn, and then depending on the modality, they go different parts of the gray matter. Some of them cross the midline, but they eventually will cross over and make contact with these axons that are the neurons that are going to go sending information up. The neurons for muscles, this is sort of interesting about the anatomy, is that the motor information, right? The cell bodies are in the dorsal horn and they're going out, which means the information that's coming down has to make those appropriate connections going down the white matter, make connections into the gray matter and find the right neuron. So when the brain theoretically says, move your pinky or move your pinky or toe moves. So those connections, it's not just about lining them up. Everything has to be lined up in the right order. And sometimes you hear the word homunculi, right? Which are these little body maps. The spinal cord has body maps. It has body maps in the white matter where the, you know, the more inner parts are the more peripheral, more caudal part, not peripheral, more caudal parts. And as you go, I'm thinking about the dorsal column, which is on the dorsal column. As you go more laterally, it picks up more and more axons from the lat, like your arms and your legs. Your legs are
so
more,
it's all interconnected.
It's interconnected, and there are these maps that are established. There are these body maps in the gray matter of the way things are connected. So it's not just about sewing it up, right? Even if the cells are going to survive, that have their cell bodies far away, you got to connect them to the right map. And those maps are sometimes determined by the lifetime of experience of that developing nervous system, right? And all that's why I keep saying all you'll ever know about the world around you is what your nervous system tells you, because those maps started being built when the nervous system started to be built. You just can't put like a new head on the top of it and have the information going up and down connecting in these.
Especially if it's a different person, like you can even talk about like I take my own head off, I put my own head back on. It's still not going to be the same.
Well,
because you still need to make all of those minute connections.
That would be a great proof of concept kind of experiment to do,
not like on
an animal, you know.
Well, I said this before we started recording, but like way back when they did do a like successful head transplant on a monkey.
Successful, in the sense that the animal survived.
Yes.
How long did it survive?
8 days.
8 days, they were able to keep it alive.
Yeah.
Being alive is not the same
as living.
As living and having it functioning as a brain, being able to control, being able to do the same things, being able to have the same fine motor control or even do all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? It might have been able to like eat and drink depending where they made the cuts, right? It's really, really complicated, and we're running out of time, but it's an interesting thing to think about for a thought experiment is, you know, is it really technically feasible, and should we be taking the dare? I can tell you in the references of that paper you sent me, it says there's a European group of bioethicists that say we should not be doing this.
We should not.
I don't know what the American equivalent of bioethicists are, if they're even dealing with it, despite these articles that are, you know, appearing in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff to think about, Dan. Unfortunately, we're at the end of this program. This is 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. We're recording live from the Digital Bronx Studios. Thank you for listening. This Health 411 program is provided by Capital Health and Rider University. Our efforts are to bring people together to address issues associated with all aspects of health and healthcare. I hope today's program has given you something to think about brain and head transplants. If you have questions and or comments about this program or want to make suggestions for future broadcasts, please email us at health411@rider.edu.
Remember, you have a doctor's appointment scheduled for every Sunday at 10 a.m. Don't miss the all-new Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Karp and our expert medical guest from Capital Health. You can listen to Health 411 anytime on demand. Go to 1077thebronx.com/health411 to listen to past episodes or tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear the weekend rewind edition of Health 411. Health 411 on 1077 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.